Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, and today on radio and podcast bring you an especially festive edition of the programme, dispensing with our usual debate format to bring you a few people's different stories. It's, if you like, Justin and friends at Christmas on this week's edition of Unbelievable. So I'm going to be joined by friends talking about their journeys and also a perennial favourite, of course, Richard Dawkins. I'll be introducing my guests shortly. Just a bit of housekeeping up at the beginning of today's show. A reminder that it's your last chance, really, this weekend to get that Christmas bundle. Two conference DVDs from Unbelievable, plus the Unbelievable book signed by myself. All available at a bargain bundle price at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Go to the show page there, click on DVD download. That'll take you to the Premier shop page where you'll be able to see that bundle available this Christmas if you want to get that for the apologetics lover in your life. The Unbelievable Christmas bundle, two Unbelievable conferences on DVD or digital download, plus the signed book from Unbelievable. Again, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on DVD download. My other very, very exciting piece of news is that I've got a date for your diary for 2020. And when I say I've got a date for your diary, that usually means only one thing. Unbelievable, the conference. That's right. We're back in London at Central Hall, Westminster on Saturday, the 9th of May, bringing you the conference a little bit earlier than usual this year. And our key speaker, I'm very excited to announce, is none other than N.T. Wright. Yes, we've been doing a lot together recently with our Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast as well. And that will feature in some ways in the conference. We're going to be doing an Ask N.T. Wright Anything live episode with our audience there at Unbelievable, the conference during the day. But more details to be announced, of course. We'll be getting the ticketing website up in January. But just wanted to give you advance notice right now to ring fence that in your diary, Saturday the 9th of May in central London. Make sure you're there for Unbelievable, the conference 2020 with N.T. Wright, our special keynote speaker. So a little later on in the show, I'm going to be sharing about some exciting conversations coming your way in early January from the programme. Right now, though, in today's festive edition of the show, we're going to be hearing the story of Jess Lester, who, having grown up in a non-practicing Jewish background in a home, rejected God, but her story changed significantly. And it had something to do with a carol service along the way. You'll hear why. Towards the end of today's show, we'll be meeting Rupert Short, the author of a new book, Outgrowing Dawkins. It's his response book to Richard Dawkins' latest anti-God offering, Outgrowing God. But right now, it's time for our Christmas show to begin by going down under. Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome onto this holiday special edition of the show Dean Mays, who is an intensive care nurse and a novelist from Adelaide and has become an unbelievable listener over the past year and a half or so. And we've struck up a friendship online. Dean's even written an article for our Unbelievable blog. And it's time for you to get to know him as well. So, Dean, welcome along to the programme.
Oh, thank you very much, Justin. It's a real honour and privilege to finally get to chat with you. For real.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the first time we have chatted together, as much as you're obviously appearing on the show as well.
Absolutely.
But that's the wonder of the online age. You can almost feel like you know someone just through having, you know, exchanged texts and emails and tweets and so on. Let's talk about how you bumped into Unbelievable, first of all, if you were Dean. I think it was actually one of our big conversation shows that first put you in contact with the show.
It was. I think, like many people, I had arrived at the sort of the phenomenon of Jordan Peterson early last year, and had started to listen to a lot of his lectures, and really a lot of what he was talking about resonated with me. And I happened to hear that he was going to be on this show called Unbelievable, and I was immediately intrigued by that. And then when I looked up the show, I was even more intrigued by the fact that there were conversations occurring between atheist guests and Christian guests. And I'm not really sure how you kind of view Jordan Peterson in terms of, you know, his Christian or non-Christian views or the like, but I think that I was craving a new style of conversation from my podcasts, because for a long time I was listening to, you know, one side of one debate and then one side of another debate, but, you know, shows that presented different sides, but not shows that presented both sides in the kind of format that your show does. And yeah, of course, when I listened to the Jordan Peterson episode, I was absolutely blown away, not only by the conversation that he had with the guest whose name escapes me
It
right now.
It was Susan Blackmore. She's yeah,
Susan Blackmore. Of course, yeah.
It was the very first one, actually, of our big conversation series back in 2018, and a very popular one, which I'm sure has been the gateway for a lot of people to discover the show. But carry on, Dean.
Yeah, and not only was I fascinated by the conversation that Susan and Jordan had, I was fascinated with how you managed the conversation, and I just it was just like a lightning bolt for me in terms of this is the sort of conversations that I've been looking to find for a long time. And after that particular conversation, I actually went back into your back catalogue and pulled out a number of episodes, and yeah, it cemented for me just how important these conversations were to somebody like myself who's really at a crossroads.
Well, let's talk about that, because
yeah, sure.
First of all, worth mentioning that you work in a pretty, to use a pun, intensive area. You are an intensive care nurse, and that kind of puts you on the front line of life and death and mortality all the time, I suppose. So I guess in a way you're confronted with big questions kind of in the line of work you do, and has that kind of been part of, I guess, your journey of trying to confront some of these issues over time?
Yeah, absolutely. You make a very good point. I have, over the last, you know, 15, 20 years, been at the forefront of some pretty intense situations in terms of patient care. And there was a time where I would have described myself as a devout atheist, purely because of just the hard cases that I was constantly being confronted with. But I want to say that it's probably been in the last 4 or 5 years that I've really started to question that, and I'm arriving at a situation now where I'm sitting here with you tonight, and I'm quite happy to say that I'm no longer an atheist, but I don't know what I am just yet. There are bigger questions that I'm grappling with, and I don't think that atheism is grappling with those questions. I could be wrong about that. I think that what I've learned from the Unbelievable program over the last year is that there's plenty of people on that side willing to address them, but I don't think that I've seen they're not willing to, they're kind of steadfast in the answers that they arrive at, whereas I'm no longer that. I don't. There's no absolutes for me anymore.
Yeah, there's you're certainly not as dogmatic as maybe you once were on those things, and you've seen,
Absolutely,
By all accounts. I mean, it's interesting to hear you say that, because I'm sure you've probably listened to the episode that aired earlier in autumn, Dave Rubin and John Lennox, and
Justin, that was one of the most wonderful, you know, inspiring discussions I think I've heard from the show. I came away feeling so positive about that episode, and just you know,
and I
the
wonder
interaction that Dave and
if that's partly because almost your story sounds a bit like Dave's, in as much as he obviously spelled out on that program how at one time he kind of came under the influence of, you know, the new atheist, Dawkins, Harris, Hitchens and co. But lately he just hasn't found that their explanations of life have been satisfactory. And like you, he said, the label atheist just doesn't fit me anymore. Not sure what I do call myself now, but I know it's not that anymore. So it sounds like you've got something in common there.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. And look, I really enjoy, you mentioned Sam Harris. I really enjoy listening to Sam Harris. But I really enjoy disagreeing with a lot of stuff that Sam Harris comes across with. But I've got no doubt that he is probably one of the most important intellectuals going around today. So there's definitely value in what he talks about. But yeah.
I'm just thrilled that you obviously have found this value in hearing those voices. I mean, I haven't had Harris on the show. Would love to actually for the next season, maybe with a big conversation. But that you're opening yourself up to that variety of perspectives. I mean, I got you to actually do a little blog for us related to one particular episode, which you were very enthusiastic about earlier in the season.
You did. Yeah.
Which was. William Lane Craig, the well-known Christian philosopher, and the celebrated cosmologist Sir Roger Penrose talking about God and the universe, and which can be quite a kind of, at one level, technical and abstract subject, but you really seem to resonate with that. Can you explain why?
Yeah, I think partly because it was the idea of mathematics being at the root of a lot of what science and faith talk about, and I've really come to hone in on that aspect of the possibilities inherent in faith and science, and where, you know, math seems to me to intersect between those two. And it actually puts me in mind of a discussion that I heard the other day between Eric Weinstein and London Tsai, who is an artist whose background is in fairly hardcore calculus, and they were discussing the idea that maths wasn't so much created by man as discovered by man. And that goes back to, that was the impression that I got from the discussion between Sir Roger and William Lane Craig, that mathematics seems to be, it's almost like the source code.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah.
And of course, I've been brought up on a healthy diet of popular culture, and I've been peripherally interested in the work of Carl Sagan, and his work, obviously, the gateway for that was the film Contact back in the mid-90s. And Matthew McConaughey played a character. He started out studying to be a priest, but I think he became more of a theologian. And his character was sort of couched in that kind of intersection between mathematics and faith.
It is a great film. I watched it for the first time actually only probably a year ago, and I thought, where has that film been all my life? It was so interesting, and did kind of really elucidate some of those you know, frontiers between science and faith and so on. And what I enjoyed about that conversation, especially between Craig and Penrose, was that there was a level of agreement you often don't get actually with the atheist Christian debates, where Penrose said, no, I actually do believe there's a kind of a mystery at the heart of the universe. And part of it was this idea of mathematics, but he also talked about consciousness. And he said, these things are things that exist kind of beyond the purview of science per se, or physical reality. They are there, if you like, in a way that defies a purely physical explanation. And of course, Craig was there to say, I agree. And what if the thing that unites those is God, essentially, is a mind that instantiated this this physical world, but that runs on this language of mathematics, and consciousness is kind of is the thing that kind of emerges from that. And again, you may not agree with that, but I think there's I just think that sometimes it's fun to bring people who are a bit closer together than, say, if you brought a Sam Harris or a Dawkins opposite Craig, where there'd be no common ground almost with those kinds of conversations.
Yeah, for sure. And look, I've listened to that Craig Penrose debate now probably four times.
Wow.
Since it aired. And each time, you know, it was so much to digest in that first listen. that I just had to go back and listen to it again, and each time I picked up more and more, and it was actually really exciting to listen to it each time, because yeah. I don't consider myself to be intellectually nimble, but you know, after a while, things kind of lodge in my brain, and I kind of get it. So
I've been hugely encouraged, really. One of the reasons I wanted to bring you on the show, because you've been so full of gratitude for the show, and you even blogged about it and wrote this article for us as well, where you said, don't call me a Christian yet, but I've started to see a purpose in the universe. Obviously, if you start listening to Unbelievable, you will hear the Christian story and the case for Christianity outlined in various different ways by different people. What extent do you find yourself drawn towards that? Or would you say, you know, actually, it's going to take something big to move you in that direction? Where do you think the journey's going as it stands, Dean?
Oh, well, look, it's been such a profound shift for me in the last probably even 6 months. Of course, you know, I listen to Unbelievable, I listen to The Profile, and also listen to your regular conversations with Tom Wright. Mm. And Tom Wright has fast become one of my most favourite people to listen to, because I just love his obviously his depth of knowledge about, it's not the ancient world, is it? It's the first century sort of
yeah.
world.
Yeah, well, that is the ancient world, but in a sense, what I think he does brilliantly is he doesn't just know a great deal about that, but he kind of connects all the dots in between now and then as well in so many interesting.
Sure.
He's something of a polymath in many ways, Tom Wright.
Absolutely. And I don't think I've ever encountered that. Well, look, I don't think I've ever encountered anybody who has brought that period of history to life as wonderfully as Tom Wright has. You know, look, I've had encounters with Anglican ministers over the years where I was growing up in country Victoria, and I remember having lovely interactions with those people, and they're always very focused on the task that they had to do, and I don't know whether they had time to kind of indulge in the greater minutiae of that world.
Yeah.
Whereas I can sit down and listen to you and Tom talk for half an hour to 40 minutes, and there's so much to discover in those conversations. And then I'll go off and I'll do some broader reading about it. I got Tom's book about Paul early this year. I actually went out and bought myself a King James Bible, which I've never actually owned a Bible before, before now. And so I'll sort of, every now and then I'll pick up something and I'll dive into it and have a read of what they were referring to, and then, kind of look at the metadata around that, or the meta conversations around that. And it's just, I don't know. It's so satisfying to be able to do that, and discover it for myself.
I'm so pleased to hear that, because I love the fact that, this show, Unbelievable, led on to you discovering Tom and the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, and obviously, obviously you don't know where it's headed, but I'm so glad to hear, that you're so open to discovering and looking into it. And what strikes me is what I think you were trying to say, maybe with that comment about Anglican ministers, is what you need, I think, it sounds like, Dean, is something where you really grapple with the underlying foundations and ideas and kind of come at it in that way. Other people obviously approach faith and religion in a very different way. It's much more about, what can it do for me right now? And that maybe is where most ministers are, on the ground are meeting people in their personal situations. But obviously, the joy of something like a podcast where we can have those extended conversations is you can kind of feed that other side of yourself, that intellectual side that needs to kind of grapple
and that
understand.
Was something that I wrote in that article for the blog. I I go back to Jordan Peterson because, I mean, he has been such a profound intellectual influence that he was saying in a lecture that he did in Sydney, about his thoughts on God and Christianity and religion, is that this is something that we must wrestle with. And I really, really like that, you know, and the more I think about it, the more important that statement seems to be to me. There's that, you know, we must wrestle with this. We must dive deep into it and really tease it out and, get into the weeds with it, because I think that's for me, that's intellectually satisfying and it's satisfying on a spiritual level. So,
I think a lot of the appeal of Jordan Peterson, and I'm noticing it, you know, I think it's hard to avoid the fact that it kind of potentially does reach a demographic. You and I are probably not that different in age, Dean, and it's a it seems to be a lot of young guys who are looking for bigger answers than perhaps the Sam Harris's and so on have been able to offer. They appreciate the kind of intellectual rigor that those guys represent. Mm. But it's hard, as Dave Rubin was saying on that show, it's hard to kind of coalesce anything around that. And especially, I think, when it comes to ultimate identity and meaning and purpose. And I think the Jordan Peterson phenomenon is partly because he kind of manages to synthesize both that intellectual rigor with a kind of really kind of taking the bull by the horns when it comes to the reality of what it is to live in the world and experience pain and suffering and to be a kind of a human with all of those elements of life. And obviously he puts kind of Christianity especially right back in the center of that and says there's a reason why people have had this narrative, whether you believe it's true or not. It's had this purpose. And I think at the moment that's producing this fascinating journey for people like you and many others that I meet who are saying, could there be something in this? Could this have the key maybe to what life is all about?
That's right. And you know, the time in which we are living, old paradigms are just not working anymore. I used to be an avid follower of politics. Well, I'm not anymore because I just think that the political conversation doesn't offer the deeper meaning to me anymore. And I think that's true of a lot of politics around the world at the moment. So I think, you know, I'm gravitating towards deeper discussions, which is sort of you and the Unbelievable Show are at the nexus of that, at the center of that, and then, you know, branching out into these other sort of areas, you know. So that's become hugely important for me as an individual, as a husband and as a father. It's very important. Yeah. So
it's been so fun and interesting to chat with you, Dean. We're obviously just getting the short version of this. Do go to Dean's blog for more, deanfromaustralia.com. You'll also discover there that Dean is a very talented novelist as well. Dean, tell us just quickly about some of your recent books that you've published.
Yeah, sure. So I've been a writer most of my life. I've loved the written word, and I often describe myself as an accidental author because I kind of gave up on the idea of ever being published. And back in 2009, I had a chance encounter, ironically on Twitter. A lot of these meaningful encounters tend to happen on Twitter. with the woman that became my publisher. And I'd been sort of penning this kind of very rough story on that blog that's now become my website. And she really liked it. And she said to me that I should consider taking it seriously. And, it evolved from there. And, in 2010, my first novel was published. And then I followed that up a couple of years later with my second novel, which was a really important one for me. It was about an Aboriginal child prodigy here in Australia who is an undiscovered violinist. And that was a really important story for sort of learning about Aboriginal history and the recent sort of experience of Aboriginals in the White Australia policy that kind of marked our mid-20th century. And then I sort of proceeded to write a political thriller after that, and then went to my latest novel, The Artisan Heart, which I wrote, was released last year, which is essentially a romance, but it actually dealt with a lot of the things that I'm sort of starting to awaken to, you know, things that we've just discussed, you know, but particularly about family relationships. And I
really enjoyed this when I read it, by the way, over the summer. You were very kind to send me a copy of it. And you know, I don't tend to read romance novels, but this wasn't your typical romance novel, I have to say. It's got a lot of depth, and it's and obviously the character, the doctor at the centre of it, I guessed there was a lot of sort of autobiographical stuff almost there because of the scenario he comes out of, this kind of, you know, working in intensive care and everything. That's obviously something you're able to put a lot of your own experience into, Dean.
So I did base a lot of that on my own experiences, both clinically and personally. And but I wanted to sort of explore relationships, you know, between kind of the parents who had passed on, his parents who had passed on, and you know, there was a lot of unresolved things there that I kind of explored, and you know, eventually came to a nice resolution about. And it was also about communication, like the character, the doctor, isn't the best communicator with people, but he strikes up this kind of communicative relationship with a young deaf child, and I wanted to sort of explore, you know, how, you know, they're able to form a relationship through sign language. And that was something that I hadn't kind of you know, encountered before. So, you know, it was, I challenged myself with these stories to try and, you know, look at human relationships in different kind of ways. So,
All I can see is you did a really good job on it, and I would highly recommend it. And I'm sure people can find links from your blog, deanfromaustralia.com. Time's just about out for our little conversation, Dean. But we're in the holiday season. How do you generally celebrate things down under in Australia?
Well, we're expecting that it'll be a lovely, warm summer's day on the 25th, and it's usually a very familial and lovely family day, which we spend here in Adelaide. I have family in Victoria too, so we tend to try and share the load year after year. But we'll be in Adelaide this Christmas, and then we're going to spend some time down on the coast, lapping up the sun, which is the complete opposite to what you guys will be doing up there, I guess. So,
it is, that's for sure. Yeah, we're starting to get some pretty bitter frosts here in the UK now, and who knows, maybe it'll be a white Christmas, but we remains to be seen. For the moment, all the very best for you and all you're doing,
and Dean, to you, Justin.
It's been really fun to chat. Great to get to know you a bit over the last 12 or 18 months since you started listening
absolutely.
To the show.
I really value our friendship, and I really value you as a teacher, Justin. You've taught me a lot over these last 18 months, and the most important thing I wanted to do out of this chat was to thank you for that, because you know, I've really taken a kind of a turn in a new direction going forward, and I may not have done that if I hadn't discovered you and the show. So,
well, that's,
thank you.
That's incredibly kind and very humbling, Dean. So, thank you very much. All the very best. Enjoy the holiday, and great to know that you're listening.
Fantastic. All the best, Justin.
Such a lovely guy. Do check out Dean's stuff if you can. Coming up next, I'll be sitting down with Jess Lester. She'll be telling me her story about why she rejected God and how he turned up again at a Christmas carol service.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
Well, it's a bit different this week on the Unbelievable podcast. We are introducing a few friends of the show, let's call them, in this holiday special. And now I'd like you to meet Jess. Jessica Lester, to give her full name, is the deputy editor of Premier Youth and Children's Work, though she's better known as Jess around the office. So we're new colleagues, relatively, Jess, because how long have you been in this position now?
Gosh, it must be 7 weeks, if that.
There you go. Yeah. So not very long.
Not very long.
How's it going?
It's really good, actually. It's great. It's great to be here with you as well. I've been looking forward to this.
Well, some Unbelievable listeners may be familiar with your boss, effectively, Ruth, who's the editor, Ruth Jackson, who's been a regular contributor at the Unbelievable Conference in our youth stream. And I hope you might contribute to that at some point in the future as well. Who knows?
Definitely. Love to.
But it's great to meet you. And we've got to know each other a little bit, just, you know, as office colleagues. But I had heard that you've got an interesting story of how you came to faith yourself. You're probably, I'm assuming, in your 20s, mid-20s?
Yeah, I'm 21.
21, there you go.
I think people find that a bit surprising.
I aged you too much.
No, it's fine.
And I think your Christian faith, in that sense, is relatively new as well. When did you become a Christian?
So I didn't actually get baptized until this May of 2019.
Right. Okay.
So extremely recent. Yeah, yeah. But I've been going to the church I've been going to for 2 years. So it's about 2 years.
I always love to hear a story of someone who's made a journey from one place to another. Mm. And I was fascinated to hear a bit of your story. I must confess, the first time I ran into your story was actually in the Sun newspaper, which I think you wrote for at one time. So that was a fascinating story where they'd really focused on the fact that you had decided, shock horror, to save sex until marriage, and what kind of a young person ever does that these days?
Yeah, that was funny actually, because I was just talking with my boss, because my lovely ex-boyfriend Josh, who we're friends now, worked in the same office as me, and they obviously knew that we were together, and my boss always had loads of questions about our faith and what it was like and what we did and what we didn't do. And we just happened to bring up the topic of celibacy one day. She was like, you know what, that's really interesting, would you write about that for us?
And for those who aren't familiar, because this show reaches a lot of people in the US who may not know what the Sun newspaper is, but it's what we call a tabloid here in the UK. It's a kind of, you know, what's a way of describing the Sun that for those who maybe have never read it before?
Oh gosh, this is a minefield for me. Well, first of all, I'll just say nicely, it's the UK's leading newspaper, but it has fun stories, news stories, features, a bit of everything. Yeah, a bit of everything.
Yeah, that's yes, okay.
But it's a bit showbizzy.
Sometimes
it can be a bit controversial.
Gossipy, kind of. Yeah, there's. I mean, yeah. So anyway. You were working as a writer at the time for it. Was there ever, we'll come to this maybe later on, but I can imagine there were some conflicts that might inevitably emerge working for, you know, that kind of a publication and a Christian faith that might be growing alongside it. But let's come to that later.
Yeah, let's talk about that later. I've got a lot to say about that, actually. That's great.
but tell us, what kind of situation did you grow up in?
So I grew up in a Jewish family background. So my parents weren't practicing, but they were both born into the Jewish faith. My grandparents were. And so I was quite heavily influenced by Jewish practice as a child. But I also went to a Christian school.
Okay.
So I had like two different faiths intertwined into my younger years. I was in the choral choir. I used to read in the church services and chapel services. I was quite heavily involved. But for me, and I think this was maybe something to do with my Jewish upbringing, is that I knew who God was, and I knew what he did, and I knew that he created the world, and he did all these amazing things in people's lives, but I didn't know that we could have a relationship with him. I didn't know it could be one-on-one.
Yeah.
Like I could talk to him, that I could have a daily conversation with him.
Right.
It was always quite distant. And so for me, I think when things in my life started to get a little bit tougher as I was growing up, that relationship just kind of distanced itself further and further instead of me pursuing it more, because I didn't know that I could.
Yeah, so in a way, you kind of had some idea of God or whatever, but it obviously wasn't very real in that way.
It was kind of like, for me, obviously at home, God was like this fairy tale that we spoke about that was in control of everything, but I'd never really seen or heard anything from. And so I was like, oh, he's out there somewhere, great. And in school, it was like, Jesus is this guy that did this wonderful thing for everybody. But once again, you know, he's never really done much in my life. So great, well done, Jesus, for doing what you did. But I don't really know you.
Yeah.
And that was hard.
And the sort of Judaism that was kind of in your home, how was that expressed? Were you sort of quite observant, or what did it look like?
So I was always involved with kind of Passover, Hanukkah. Like, I was cooking with my grandparents, and I would go to the synagogue with them when I was very young. I would go with them. I stopped going as I got a bit older because I found it all a little bit boring. But yeah, I used to go along, and we'd talk about it a lot, and we'd talk about faith a lot with my grandparents because they were quite involved,
quite devout themselves.
Whereas my parents
were less so.
And just kind of, we were like I guess what you'd say, like a Sunday Christian, like
culturally
a Friday night Jew.
So I guess at this point, by the time I guess you reach your teens, we're not too sure about the whole God thing. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, I think I definitely knew something was out there, but I wasn't 100% convinced. Yeah. Like, nothing had convinced me that I felt that Jesus was there for me. And so I had a lot of questions. And I think one thing for me that was prevalent looking back in my childhood is that nobody answered these questions. And maybe I wasn't explicit enough in asking them. But when I had questions, no one really took the time to answer them for me. And I wasn't in a church setting, and that's difficult because I feel like if I was at a youth group and I asked a question, they'd have a whole range of answers for me. But because I was outside of that group, I had so many questions but no answers.
So what happened next? I understand there were some sort of big emotional sort of things that came up in your life in terms of people you were close to.
And this is where God and I started to drift a lot more than, well, I mean, we already weren't close, but this was like serious drifting. So my parents separated when I was a young child, which is obviously quite traumatic for any child that's been through that will know. Following that, my mum was diagnosed with a brain tumour, and we didn't really know what was going to happen. We thought maybe she would die. We weren't sure. It was a lot to handle. And I don't think I could handle it now at 21 years old, let alone at 12, when I was trying to deal with all of this. And the resulting operation for her to have her brain tumour removed meant that she was ever so slightly traumatised, and had a real struggle with her mental health, which was, again, really hard for me to have to sit and watch through as a 13-year-old. Following that, one of my best friend, Grace, who was diagnosed with cancer in her childhood, had a brain hemorrhage and lost her ability to walk and to talk. And I spent a lot of time, probably twice or three times a week, at the hospital with her, practicing how to speak, practicing how to walk, practicing numbers and words, really pouring my life into making her better. And at this time, when we were at the hospital, the chaplain was frequently there, and we would frequently pray over her, and we'd pray for her, and we'd make sure that we were doing that, because that's what we've been told to do. You know, Grace will be healed if we pray for her. Grace will get better if we pray for her. And so I was really trying to get involved. I was really trying to speak to God about it. But yeah, unfortunately, Grace had a second brain hemorrhage and wouldn't recover. And so her parents made a decision that it wouldn't be fair to bring her back round from the second time. And she passed away when she was 15. I was also 15. And that was hard.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be... I can't imagine quite what effect that has on when you lose a friend, especially at that time of life when you're processing so much anyway.
Yeah.
That is a huge emotional crisis to have to cope with.
For sure. And it was one of the worst times in my life. I was very down and couldn't seem to get myself out of it. And I think for me at that time, that is when I just had enough. I'd had enough of God. I'd had enough of this unanswered prayer, of this ridiculousness where I've been told if we pray for Grace, she'll get better. If we pray for her, she'll be okay. She'll recover. If we keep praying and praying and praying, everything's going to be okay, because you know God is good and God is wonderful. Actually, what that meant was, when Grace passed away, it was like, no, God's taken her away from me. God's taken the person that I love dearly. God's taken away this person that I've poured my life into and that I care about. And it just left me with so many questions, like, why her? Why not me? Why good people? Because at that time, I kind of thought that it was God's will. I kind of thought it was God's will that this child that had done nothing wrong was condemned to die. I now know that obviously God's will isn't that we have to suffer. He wants for our good. He wants to love us, and he wants us to have good times. And Jesus weeps at the brokenness of our world in which these kind of things happen. But at the time when people were saying to me like, oh, she's in a better place, or sometimes things happen, we don't understand why, it made me feel like it was God's will that she was taken away.
It can often be in those times that well-meaning sort of words like that can actually be quite unhelpful.
Yeah.
If theologically they just kind of raise more questions than give you answers, because it can make God look like, well, some kind of monster almost, you know.
Kind of.
Why, you know, somehow we're supposed to believe that God intended for all this to happen because of some greater purpose that we're obviously unaware of at this point.
Yeah, and when you're 15, it's really difficult to imagine that there's a greater purpose for all the suffering that you're going through. And of course, suffering is relative, and I was always aware that my suffering wasn't that great compared to other people's, but when you're living your life and you're a teenager and you're already going through all those emotional changes, and then all of this suffering is kind of piled on top, you're like, what's the point of all of this?
Right.
I don't understand. Mm. I don't understand why I or all my friends or the people that I love are having to go through this. What's the point here?
And I suspect that's the point you reached at the age of 15, but many people reach it at some point in their lives, whether they be Christian or not, where essentially I think they say, I'm not sure I can believe this anymore, because if this is the way the world is, if this is what happens, then where's God? What's the point of believing in a God who loves us if this kind of thing is going to happen?
Yeah.
So where did it go from there? Because at this point it sounds like a pretty bleak picture, frankly.
Yeah, it was bleak. It was a bad time for me, and I was so hurt and I was so angry. I was just full of anger and hatred that I remember sitting in my bedroom and looking up at the sky, and in a nice way of saying it without saying exactly what I said, basically saying like, God, I want nothing to do with you anymore. I can't have anything to do with you anymore, because you have taken something away from me that I can't forgive you for. I cannot forgive you for this. I cannot let you do this kind of thing. I can't be involved with you if this is the kind of person or being that you are. I can't. And so I kind of vowed in my head this very dangerous, self-destructive behavior that I was just going to do everything I could to just go against everything I knew that was right.
Okay.
Because I wanted to show God that I was better than that, and I could, I didn't need him, and I could do everything by myself. Silly mistake that I made. But I decided to go out a lot. I was drinking a lot. I dabbled a bit with drugs. Obviously, from the Sex Piece and the Sun, most people will know already that like waiting for sex until marriage was not something that I believed in. I became a bit of a wild child. I became a bit rebellious, which was definitely not who I was before all of this had happened.
So there was quite a character transformation for a while.
Yeah. And I think I kept a lot of it under wraps from my family, and I was trying to pretend to be this the person I was before. But when I was with my friends or I was alone, I was definitely not the same. I was definitely not the same. And I just wanted so badly to prove to God that I could just...
Right.
I could do it by myself.
Was it kind of like, was that going on almost subconsciously? Do you think that sort of, I'm going to show you, God, that I can do this life without you,
for sure,
perfectly happy. I mean, were you consciously thinking of that when you were going out partying and everything, or was that sort of more kind of somewhere in the back of your mind?
I think sometimes it was conscious.
Right.
I think sometimes I was very aware I was doing things wrong, but I just didn't care enough. And I think you can picture it like when you have an argument with somebody that you really care about. You're like, I'll show you. Fine, I'll show you. I can do this. I can do that. It was the same for me. It's like, fine, if we're going to go there, if you're going to hit me that deep, I'm going to hit you back.
Wow.
Like, I'm going to strike you back, because I knew that God didn't like it when people go against what he says. I knew that. And so I just thought, well, that's what I'm going to do.
Wow. So it was kind of a very conscious rebellion in that sense.
And
where did that get you to? Did you have any moments within that when you wondered where this was all leading or anything else?
Honestly, it got me nowhere. In fact, life got a lot worse. Things got a lot darker for me. And because I was filled with this like rebellious nature, it was just a lot of hatred and a lot of anger, as I was saying earlier. And that just continues to bubble in you as you go through this rebellion, because it's fueled, right? Rebellion is fueled by like that anger and hatred, and that was just within me all the time. And I just went through a couple of years of my life of just being so angry and so self-destructive, and that self-destructive behavior eventually turned into kind of like self-harming,
right?
Self-harm behavior, like, I don't care what I do to myself, because frankly I don't matter and I don't really want to live anymore. And I just didn't really have any respect for myself anymore. So it started off as a rebellion against God, and it ended up being against myself.
So this would have been in your mid to late teens that you started going through that sort of very destructive behaviour, culminating in self-harm and so on.
Yeah.
I mean, it strikes me that in the last, I don't know, decade or so, that has become a huge issue. Mental health issues generally have become huge among young people. And I mean, everyone has their own story, I suppose. But were you seeing that kind of behaviour in among your peers as well, in terms of anxiety, depression, self-harm and so on?
Yeah. Yeah, and I still do.
Right.
I mean, 21-year-olds aren't out of the adolescent stage. No. We're still going through it. And I still have friends that are struggling. I mean, some days I still struggle.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely saw it a lot. But I think it's because young people are searching for something, but they don't really know what they're searching for. And no one's giving them the answer. And that's kind of linked back to what I said about me not being in a youth group. I had all these questions, but no one could answer them for me. And I was searching, I was searching, I was searching. What I was searching for was God's love.
Right.
I wanted that love, but I didn't know how to get it.
And as someone who has, you know, grown up a digital native, as they say, someone who, I'm guessing you, Jess, have always been on social media since you can be, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
To what extent would you say all of that dimension has kind of shaped the way young people feel and the way you were feeling about yourself and you know, those issues you were dealing with at that time?
Yeah, so in the January edition of YCW Mag, which is what I deputy edit, I've written a really honest piece about my mental health journey. And in that, I reference the fact that I went on some medication for my mental health for a while. And the reason I was okay with it was because I went on Tumblr and I searched about this medication, and people, like other young people, were telling me how wonderful it was and how amazing it was. But also other young people were talking about the same kind of feelings that I was having, that about self-harm and about suicide and about hatred and anger. And I think social media in some ways does fuel the fire, because young people are so willing to talk about it on social media and kind of let out all of these feelings. Actually, first of all, it makes people think that it's okay to feel that way,
okay,
because other people are feeling that way. But secondly, there's also a pressure, isn't there, to perform on social media, to have this fake life, to have it all together, everything's figured out. Yeah, I definitely think I felt that from a young age. I mean, I was on Facebook from 12 years old.
Yeah,
obviously not allowed to before you're 14. But I remember all of my peers at school would were on Facebook as early as we could be, and then there was that pressure to have the perfect Facebook profile with the funniest photos. Yeah. And yeah, it definitely doesn't help with mental health issues in children, because it just makes them want to be or have to be someone that they're not.
I've got that sense as well. I mean, I have my daughter, and I can see as she starts to move into that world, I'm so aware of that Instagram culture of, you know, all of these influencers who look like, you know, they've just stepped out of a beauty salon. And I'm so aware that I don't want her to be molded by that kind of expectation of who you're supposed to be. But I'm so aware that we're fighting against something that's huge, that's almost impossible, because that is the way young people to some extent are negotiating life now, is via these networks as much as in person with
their
friends.
It's like parents versus multi-billion dollar corporations, right? Yeah, and we all know who's likely to win in that situation. But yeah, for me, social media has always been a difficult one. I now try and be as open as I possibly can about my faith, about the struggles that I've been through, about everything, because I feel like I want to start opening up and letting young people see that, like, it's okay to be vulnerable, it's okay to talk about these things on social media, for sure.
Bit of a digression anyway, but come back to your story, because sort of this was, you were heading, I guess, towards sixth form, university type years.
Yes.
Where does the story go
so
now?
I was about 17 when things were really starting to get bad for me, and this is where actually the story starts to turn around, but it's in a very unlikely situation. So I was at a festival in the summer of, it must have been 2016, and it was at this set by the 1975, which is also ironic because they are huge humanists. They're completely against any form of organized religion.
Right.
But there is one song on one of their albums titled If I Believe You, and it's the lead singer of the band, Matt Healy, musing about Jesus and about God and what it all means. And I've got some of the lyrics here for you. It starts off with, I've got a God-shaped hole that's infected. And as soon as I heard those lyrics, it was like someone just smacked me around the face. I was like, wow, that's me. I've got a God-shaped hole that's infected. I feel like I'm needing something and it's just festering away at me. Mm. It's so filled with hatred. Anyway, the song goes on and the chorus starts off, "If I believe you, will that make it stop? If I told you I need you, is that what you want? I'm broken and bleeding and begging for help." And I am at this festival concert in the middle of the crowd and I am sobbing, sobbing my eyes out, and I don't really know why. I am crying, and the next line I scream out at the top of my lungs. And I'd heard this song loads of times. I had it on my Spotify and I pretty much listened to it about 15 times a day. My mum will tell you that period of my life I had it on constantly because I was searching for the same thing that is being said in the song. And I remember at this festival standing in the crowd and screaming at the top of my lungs and really meaning it, the final line of the chorus, which is, "I'm asking you, Jesus, show yourself." And wow. I think, okay, it's not a Christian song. These people that wrote it aren't Christians, but there's power in saying those words and meaning those words, regardless of where they've come from. And I really did. I screamed out as loud as I possibly could, "I'm asking you, Jesus, show yourself," because I was just so fed up with this life that I was living of self-hatred and harm and just horror. It wasn't nice at all. And small things started changing for me. But it got worse before it got better. And it's funny because now I look back and I think about that verse, which is like, "The things that were meant for evil I made for your good." And I definitely feel that was the truth. So about a couple of months later, after the festival, I went to university. I was taking medication for mental health at this time. And about 2 months into university, I thought it would be a good idea for me to stop taking them. And instead of taking them, I wanted to save them up and then take them all in one go.
Gosh, okay.
Yeah, I had quite serious suicidal thoughts. And I was seeing a counsellor and they were doing their best, but nothing was helping me. And I was talking to God about it every now and again. I was listening to this song quite frequently and saying quite frequently, "I'm asking you, Jesus, show yourself." Anyway, things got so bad that one day I left university and drove all the way home. And I said to my mum, I remember coming in and saying to my mum, "Mum, I want to die and I'm scared and I need help." And she said, "Okay, that's okay, we're going to help you." And I don't really remember much about the conversation, but I remember us having a long embrace afterwards. And I was very unwell. I was very unwell. But in that darkness, Jesus started to appear in little tiny, tiny ways. The first way was like just the smallest thing for me, like being able to get out of bed and having a shower, having the ability to go outside, enjoying the fresh air and singing and having enjoyment in things that I'd lost enjoyment in for a while. It's just little tiny things that now looking back, I'm like, yeah, God was really in that space. He was really working hard to fight his way into that space. So I built a wall around myself, really. And he was working hard to kick that wall down. But yeah, what was meant for evil worked out for my good, because I ended up within a matter of months of leaving university and going through this horrific time of my life where I wanted to die. Within a couple of months of that, I just landed my dream job at the Sun newspaper.
Yep.
My first job. I was 19 years old and I just waltzed in to the biggest publication in the UK. And it was crazy because I didn't believe I could do it, but I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all through God's grace. I know that now. But it was unbelievable that this just happened to me. I'd had all of this rubbish and all of a sudden, breakthrough. And from that, that's where I met my ex-boyfriend Josh in training for the Sun newspaper, and we got quite close. And he kept pestering me and saying, "Hey, you know, come to church with me, you know, it'll be good for you, it'll be good for you." And I kept saying, "No, you don't understand. Me and God go way back." We go way back, and
it's not good.
And it's not good. I'm telling you, it's not good. You don't want to know what kind of conversations me and God have had. And he's like, "No, trust me in this one. I don't know what you and God have had before, but let's start something fresh with God." So eventually he broke me down and he said, "Look, it's the carol concert. You can't not like carol concerts. It's candlelight, it's carols, you like to sing. Fine, I'll come along to that." So I end up going, and when I'm there I meet all the lovely people and all my now best friends, and they were amazing. Everyone was so kind and lovely. And at the end of it, he's like, "So you're gonna come back next week?" I was like, "It wasn't that bad, was it? It wasn't that bad. Fine, I'll come back next week. I mean, the next 3 weeks anyway, it's going to be all Christmas stuff. I know the story of the Christmas story. I know about Jesus being born. Great, I love the story. It's a fantastic story. Nativity's fun. Cool, I'll come back." It gets to January. Alpha starts being prodded towards me. Fine, fine. Mainly, I found out there was free dinner and I was absolutely up for that. No,
Typical student type life.
Yeah.
Free food.
Free food. And I'd made some friends and they were running it. And so I thought, you know what? I'll just go and see what it's like. And if I don't like it after the first one, I won't go back. Mm-hmm. And we went for a couple and there was lots of tears and lots of hard times at that Alpha course. Specifically, the week where we talked about suffering was a hard week for me. And there was lots of crying and lots of turmoil. But I still went back anyway because I felt like something in me had just been lit up.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was a piece of paper and someone had just put a torch on me and they were like, here we go. Let's start answering these questions that I've had for my whole life at last.
Yes.
Great, I've got a space where I can ask all these questions and someone can finally start giving me some answers. Yeah. And it just kind of started from there.
Yeah.
And from there, I started going to church every week. I started really enjoying myself, getting involved, got myself a Bible, started reading it from the very beginning. I wanted to know everything. You know, I wanted to know everything about Jesus. I wanted to have all my questions answered. I was just very excited. And yeah, it's just been a beautiful journey since then.
Really, really interesting. I mean, coming back to the job you were doing at the time, which we mentioned earlier, working for the Sun newspaper. And we weren't very explicit earlier for the sake of, as I say, the American listeners on the podcast. But it's a publication not all Christians necessarily approve of, in the sense that it's known for its page three girls, at one time at least, up till recently topless, now very scantily clad, and stories that are quite often on the more kind of scintillating, sort of gossipy, sexy, whatever side. So did that ever kind of throw up any contradictions as you started to grow in your Christian faith and were doing that job?
So I love this question because I always surprise people when I tell them that there is a huge Christian union over at News UK, which
really?
Is what is the kind of
the parent company
that owns the Sun and the Times newspaper, both work in the same building. And people are always like, oh, no way. I'm like, yeah, yes way. We worked really closely with Southwark Cathedral. The Dean of Southwark frequently came in to talk with us. We have a carol service, an Easter service.
Interesting.
There are a lot of Christians in that building that only when I became a Christian and started talking about it did I realize
there were
others in there.
Interesting.
There were times definitely where I felt a little bit uneasy. There were stories where perhaps I'd written it one way and it would have got more hits had I written it another.
Right.
But I had to protect what I felt was right and what I wanted in that. But the reason I left wasn't because I felt like it contradicted my faith at all. It's just I felt like I wanted to be more involved in a faith-based publication,
And I'm sure while you were with The Sun, you obviously were aiming to put your faith to good use in that scenario, and no one in any work situation, secular work situation, I'm sure ever, you know, there's always going to be contradictions and things that they have to navigate. But I'm guessing for you, it was an enormous opportunity as well as a Christian to influence people.
For sure, and that's where the Sex Before Marriage piece came about.
Yeah,
because even the smallest little hint that I'm doing it for Jesus is a huge thing to get into the Sun newspaper.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah, yeah.
To even mention the fact that I'm doing it because I'm a religious Christian.
Yeah.
That was like mind-blowing for a lot of people because they did not expect that that could ever be done, like that anyone could ever talk about their faith, even in like the most minuscule hinting at kind of way.
What reaction did that story get when it came out?
Everyone was super positive.
Right.
And that kind of... I was very surprised because I thought that a lot of people would poke fun at me and obviously they did in some, my friends did because it's funny that I would be so explicit to the entire country basically. Millions of people read the paper every day and I'm willing to talk about A, how many sexual partners I've had in the past and then B, the fact that I don't with my current. But yeah, it was a really positive thing and in the office I got so much praise. So many people I did not expect as well to enjoy it coming up to me and being like, look, just want to say big respect for what you did the other day and I think it's great that you're doing it. I was like, wow, I did not expect that from you of all people, but thank you, like that's really I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, you're now with us here at Premier and putting your writing talents to very good use at Premier Youth and Children's Work magazine. I've really enjoyed reading some of your stuff that you started writing.
Thanks,
and looking forward to this January edition, which is out now, I think, as the when this show airs.
Yes, it is.
So I mean, you say you wanted to work in a more sort of faith-based publication, in that way. To what extent, I suppose, have your values and way of looking at life shifted in that time that you've obviously become a Christian and gone on this quite new journey?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny when you say, like, I wanted to work in a faith-based publication. All of this came about just through the grace of God and just him doing the little God whispers and little points towards the places I should be going. It wasn't really necessarily my direction. It was his direction, and I was just more willing to follow. You know, I met Ruth through the sex piece,
right?
And she sent me a text message one day saying, hey, we don't know each other, but I loved this, I work for this magazine for youth and children, will you talk about this for me? And I was like, yeah, sure. And turns out that we got on like an absolute house on fire. She dropped in that she needed a deputy editor, would I come in for an interview? And I said yeah, why not? And it just all the ball just kept rolling. But yeah, I think what's changed for me, the main thing that springs to mind is the fact that I now know that everything that I've been through wasn't because God wanted me to suffer. God wasn't causing me to suffer. Like I said, Jesus weeps for the ones that suffer. But actually, in all the suffering, all the things that I've been through, I've been able to learn and therefore been able to impart knowledge and use these experiences for good. And turn them around and help people with what I've been through and not actually think of myself as the victim, but actually think of myself as like almost be joyful at what I've been through, because it means that I'm now going to be able to use it as a force for change.
I mean, and the verse you've quoted a couple of times, you know, what you intended for evil, God intended for good.
I mean, I could talk about that endlessly.
The story of Joseph in the Old Testament that comes from.
Yeah.
You're almost, you know, so many times we hear stories like yours and they remind me of a modern version of the Joseph story.
Yeah.
It all looks terrible.
Yeah.
But God is able to weave something out of even the worst situations. He's the God who redeems us.
Yeah.
The God who redeems our situations, the God who turned the tragedy of the cross into the triumph of the resurrection.
100%. I definitely feel like that's been done in my life. Obviously not to the same glorious extent as that, but yeah.
But we're all meant to, in some way, you know, what gives me great hope and encouragement hearing your story is that to some extent the Christian life is always meant to be a reflection of that much bigger story. It's meant to be a story where Jesus' story shines out through our own story, and I'm so glad to have met you and to know that, and for you to be able to share your story.
Yeah, I'm so happy to share it. I really appreciate you having me on.
Great to have you on. Jess, thank you so much. Jessica Lester. Jess is the deputy editor of Premier Youth and Children's Work magazine. I'm going to test you now, Jess. Where should people go if they want to get a free sample copy of the latest edition of the magazine?
They can go to the website, which is youthandchildrens.work/free copy.
That was youthandchildrens.work/free copy.
Exactly that.
Great. Have a very happy new year, Jess.
And you, yeah.
And I look forward to working with you into 2020.
Yeah, for sure.
Glad to be bringing you today's festive edition of the show and podcast. And in part three of today's programme, we'll be meeting Rupert Short, the author of Outgrowing Dawkins. Do come back again very soon.
The Unbelievable podcast has been hosting the conversation between Christians and skeptics for over a decade. They're sometimes friendly, sometimes feisty, but always fruitful, I hope, in helping you understand faith, reason, and culture. If you enjoy the show, please consider supporting it. It'll help me to continue to create these conversations that matter through video, podcast, and online resources. And as a thank you for any gift you give, we'll send you all of the video sessions from Unbelievable the Conference USA, featuring John Lennox, Mary Jo Sharp, J. Warner Wallace, Brian Brodison, and others. To support the show, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on Give.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's festive edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, dispensing with our usual debate/conversation format to bring you a few stories from various people. And we've already heard today from Dean and Jess, and I'll be introducing in this third part of the programme Rupert Short and his response book to Richard Dawkins very shortly. Just a reminder before we get into that, that Unbelievable the Conference is coming again for 2020. do put it in your diary, Saturday the 9th of May, special guest N.T. Wright for this coming conference. So really looking forward to hosting that at Central Hall Westminster in London. Again, our venue for last year's conference, bit earlier in the year this time though, so wanted to give you some advance notice. We will be getting all of the details, speakers and indeed ticketing up in January, so look out for that. If you want to keep abreast of all things Unbelievable, why not subscribe to the newsletter? You can go to the show page and simply click there to subscribe on newsletter. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. That'll keep you up to date with things like the latest shows. I'm excited to say we've got some crackers coming in the next few weeks. Now, the next show, before we get to the end of the new year, will again be a sort of holiday special. We'll be hearing from Mary Jo Sharp, who's an apologist out in the USA. She was part of our team speaking at Unbelievable, the Conference USA, and we'll hear some highlights from that California conference and remind you how you can get hold of all of the video sessions from the conference. But then we're really starting the new year with a bang as we go into a couple of shows. The first one in the new year will be Douglas Murray, who's the author of The Madness of Crowds, a very interesting, popular, somewhat controversial book. He describes himself as a Christian atheist, and he's in conversation with Esther O'Reilly, who's a Christian blogger. That's a fantastic conversation. You won't want to miss that on both video and podcast early in the new year. And then we'll be having the final part of our Big Conversation series, season two, as we have for the final episode of that, Glenn Scrivener and Matt Dillahunty meeting to debate morality and can atheism deliver a better world. So look out for that again in the early part of January on both video and podcast and radio. Lots to look forward to from the Unbelievable show. Thank you very much for all of those who have been listening to the show over the last year, and indeed new people who have been binge listening to the show. I'm going to bring you a little later on the story of Joe and his incredible listening feat, because he's been through every single episode in the back catalogue in less than a year and a half. And he wanted to write to tell me about it. So I will bring that email, as well as some others of your thoughts and responses to recent programme, towards the end of today's show. Now, were you aware that the well-known atheist Richard Dawkins has another anti-God book out? Well, it's time to catch up with another special guest on this week's holiday edition of the show. Really pleased to be joined now by Rupert Short, who's the author of a new book. In fact, he produces a lot of books at the moment, Outgrowing Dawkins, God for Grown-Ups. And as the title suggests, it's very much a response to Richard Dawkins' new book, Outgrowing God, A Beginner's Guide to Atheism. So welcome along to the show, Rupert.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. As I say, this is the second book I think you've produced this year. And in a way, quite a tight turnaround on this one, I imagine, because I know that Richard Dawkins' book only came out, what, in September, and already your book is now available.
You bet. I've been scribbling like mad. This is my second visit to your studio in 6 months. In March, I published a wee book called Does Religion Do More Harm Than Good, which we discussed. That had a fairly long gestation, but Outgrowing Dawkins was written in about 3 weeks flat during a so-called holiday in September of this year.
Some holiday. You must have got wind then at some point that Dawkins was doing this sort of follow-up, I suppose, to The God Delusion, which I think was released more than 10 years ago now. I've heard that this book by Dawkins is sort of that book for teenagers or something like that. I don't know. What exactly do you think Dawkins was trying to do with this new release?
That's right. I'm not sure that an enormous amount has changed. Richard Dawkins remains the Victorian rationalist that he seems to have been ever since about the age of 15, and he's stuck in what seems to me a very old style paradigm, that there's hard knowledge which comes from the natural sciences, and everything else is just
subservient to that,
wishful,
in some way
or nonsensical or dodgy. And Outgrowing God doesn't really seem different in substance from The God Delusion. They're very, very similar.
Treads a lot of the same sort of ground, we can assume. I'd be interested to know, before we come to talking about what you've written in response, and as I say, you had quite a tight deadline to do that, to get a response book out before Christmas. What do you think is the general reception these days to Dawkins? 10 years ago, when The God Delusion came out, could be argued that was sort of the apex, the zenith of the new atheist movement. Do you think the conversation's moved on a bit since then?
It may have moved on slightly. I thought that it would be interesting to get some of Dawkins's fellow non-believers to do my work for me. It's quite easy to quote Christians, for example, who've shaken their fists at Dawkins. When you have a major article in a magazine like The New Humanist on the failure of the new atheism, such as appeared in June of this year, taking these figures to task, Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, for gross arrogance, really, just a tendency to misinterpret, distort what they're attacking. I say at one point in my book, look, if someone were to say, I'll have nothing to do with the left because of the crimes of Stalin, all left-wing thought is by definition incoherent in theory and ruinous in practice. Or if somebody were to say the same about the right, to say, you know, all right-wing thought is fascistic, we won't give a moment's consideration to Angela Merkel or whoever. That if someone were to be that extreme in the political realm, they wouldn't be given the time of day by serious people. And this is what's happened with the new atheism. These authors have, of course, been pushing at an open door, and they've been hugely successful in their time. But as you imply, perhaps the moment has passed a bit.
It's interesting that you say perhaps, you know, it's not that hard to find critics within Dawkins' own camp in that sense. I suppose, does it feel like some people feel like he's actually become a dogmatist in his own sort of field, as much as he critiques those who are dogmatic in religious terms?
Oh, very much. I mean, the New Humanist article quotes a conversation between these guys, which was reproduced in print in a book called The Four Horsemen. I think that appeared earlier this year. And one of their foremost celebrity cheerleaders is Stephen Fry, as many of our listeners no doubt know. And Stephen Fry, whom I admire in many ways, salutes these men. It is rather revealing, sadly, that they are all a certain kind of man. He salutes them as the Four Musketeers. That's another sobriquet that's been applied to them. Well, I say in an aside, the martial analogy is apt. These guys, they are able sword wielders, gunslingers, but they are much less handy with scalpels.
That's an interesting way of putting it. So you bring your own scalpel to the new atheism, to Dawkins, to his book, Outgrowing God, in your own book here, Outgrowing Dawkins. I suppose it was inevitable that would be the
yes,
title.
Yes, good for search algorithms.
Yeah, absolutely. God for Grown-Ups. I like the subtitle too. So you've divided your book into three sections. It's a relatively short book as well, it should be said. It won't take you long to get
very
through.
Brief,
very
yes.
brief. And sometimes that's a benefit for people who want something that's a quick response. It starts, though, the first chapter with a dialogue of the deaf. What's that referring to?
That's just giving an overview, really, and talking about the way that so much of this debate seems to be conducted at cross purposes. If I say that my favourite fruit is apple, and you say that your favourite fruit is a pear, we are at least in agreement about what it is that we disagree about. But the debate about theism and atheism tends not to even reach first base, because the God in whom Richard Dawkins disbelieves is a grown-up creature, not the deity of classical theism. And one of the things I want to make clear is that on a classical understanding, The first thing you realise when you get out of short theological trousers is that the relationship between God and creation is a is a non-competitive one. God is not a great big thing jostling for elbow room with lesser things like us. And a pillar of orthodoxy like Thomas Aquinas could not have been clearer. I mean, God belongs to no genus. You can't, to cite a crazy thought experiment, add up all the things in the universe and reach the number N and then say, oh, and because I also happen to believe in God, the final total is N plus one. It doesn't work like that.
As the title of a book before these books, God is No Thing, that you published, makes clear. And that really does delve into some of those classical arguments.
That's right. Yeah. What I've tried to do in Outgrowing Dawkins is to provide a sort of boil and a restatement of some of the arguments spelt out at more length in God is No Thing. So if you think this latest book is a bit skimpy, by all means, refer back to the earlier publication.
Sure. But in a way, it's interesting you say that, because I have heard other Christians say something very similar, that, well, I don't believe in the God Richard Dawkins doesn't believe in either, because it's a straw man, essentially, that he's demolishing.
We're all atheists with respect to the God in whom Richard Dawkins disbelieves. And if you start by looking at religion as involving an abusive relationship with a Zeus-like figure who idly makes his creatures with all their imperfections and then threatens them with torture if they don't adore him, then I think you're missing something fairly fundamental, to put it no more strongly than that.
Now, I should say, for the benefit of listeners who are listening now, normally this format of the show is you'd be hearing a response from an atheist. And we would love to hear a response from Richard Dawkins. I have quite a few times now in this year invited Richard via his publisher to come on the show. That has not resulted in any fruit yet, but we hope it may yet. So Richard is the table is waiting. The chair is empty. If you want to sit in it, you are more than welcome to come to this studio and defend this book. But for the moment, we're just hearing from Rupert Short, who's written this this response book, Outgrowing Dawkins. Section two of your book, Rupert, God for Grown-Ups. Okay, tell us a bit about that.
Well, the whole of Richard Dawkins's book could be summed up with two, I kid you not, I mean, two extraordinarily simple arguments. The first half of the book gives lots of examples of toxic religion, and he begins by having a lot of fun with talking about pagan deities from antiquity. And he says, I don't believe in Zeus, I don't imagine you do either, I don't believe in Votan, I don't believe in this silly fertility goddess over there from that culture, I don't believe in that silly god from that culture over there. And Yahweh, the Old Testament god, that's the word he describes, he uses to describe the God of Jesus Christ. Yahweh is simply one other iteration, one other figure in this
undergrowth. The pantheon of
that's
gods,
right. Not different qualitatively, and in the same way that a skeptic won't have any truck with belief in Zeus, they're likely to disbelieve in Yahweh as well, at least if they're sensible. So, in other
words, he sometimes puts it, as many of his new atheist colleagues do, as this idea that, well, you're an atheist when it comes to Zeus, Brahma, you know, Vishnu.
I believe in one less God.
I simply believe in one less God than you do. And that's a sort of, well, it's a clever line, but I suppose the question is there much substance to that way of framing it?
Yes, indeed. Well, you say it's a clever line, and you're right, but it reminds me of another entertaining line. On the surface, Richard Dawkins is profound. Deep down, he's superficial. Let's introduce a little bit of rigor to this conversation. Yes, ancient societies were polytheistic, But over time, there was a refinement of the vision. Richard Dawkins begins by explaining a bit of Greek etymology to us, what the meaning of the word polytheism is. He misses the one piece of Greek that really matters in this context, which is between ho theos, which translates literally as the God, and theos without the article. Now, that probably corresponds with a distinction in English between God spelt with and without a capital G. There was a refinement of the vision, as I say, and in not only late antique paganisms, but in traditions around the world, you could see it emerging in Hinduism, for example, as well as in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, a much more sophisticated vision as the of God as the sole source of reality, who doesn't stand on the same plane as creation. So that's one of the conceptual areas that I want to try to get clear about, because Richard Dawkins has even made the surreal claim that God would need to have evolved by a process of natural selection, and that there is no evidence of any life form in the universe more sophisticated than humanity. So the God being posited here, wait for it, is both the cause of the universe and a product of it. I mean, phalluses don't come much bigger than that.
Right. And for you, it's important to acknowledge that when Richard Dawkins says, "I simply believe in one less God than you," well, there's a very big difference between the God of classical theism and the sort of panoply of gods that he dismisses. It's important to understand what sort of God you're dealing with, because simply ticking one more off the list is rather different to saying there is no ultimate metaphysical source of reality.
That's right. I was saying earlier that his book boils down to two statements. One is, religion is very toxic on the basis of the many deeply one-sided examples that he offers. Then in the second half of the book, he changes tack and he gives what I must say is an admirably lucid, really, really helpful summary of the current scientific consensus on the origin of the biosphere. Okay. As long as Richard Dawkins is talking about biology, I think he's a great communicator, a great popularizer. Earlier books of his, like the Ancestor's Tale, I really enjoy. The problem is the metaphysical conclusion that he imposes on that evidence, which is precisely a very, very unscientific one. His line essentially is, because evolution is true, that explains the existence of the world. As though evolution could explain the whole of reality. He has, as a kind of intellectual beard here, a theoretical physicist in America called Lawrence Krauss, a man who's written a book I'm sure you're familiar with, A Universe from Nothing. But that in turn rests on assumptions about the prior existence of a quantum vacuum. Mm. A quantum vacuum is not
nothing.
Nothing. It is an entity within a structured cosmos, and the core point here is that naturalism, philosophically, the belief that everything can ultimately be explained in the language of natural science, naturalism is highly questionable, because it is not possible in the terms naturalism allows to say how anything at all could exist. So that's
we all come one of the in arguments. A sense with a certain number of assumptions, or almost dogmas in this case to our worldview, and you would like Richard Dawkins and others, I suppose, to recognise that a little bit more, rather than simply assuming that this is the way things are. Third section, live and let live, of your response book. What's
well,
that about?
The second section is by far the longest, and it falls into five subsections. Mm-hmm. So I talk about something rather than nothing. I talk about the meaning of monotheism, as we've discussed. I talk about scripture and ethics because Richard Dawkins's understanding of the Bible is so immensely crude. I mean, it's an absolute mirror image of the fundamentalism that he rejects.
In a funny way, though, I think Dawkins would like us all to read the Bible in a very fundamentalist way, because in a way it's far easier to poke holes and knock it down that way. So there's a sense in which the fundamentalist is his friend as much as it's his enemy.
You score easy victories, but of course I don't think of fundamentalism as a traditional expression of Christianity.
Sure.
I mean, a bit like Islamic fundamentalism, it leapfrogs over centuries of tradition. The Bible, there's something a little bit hollow about the scripture tradition battle, although some aspects of it make sense. But the Bible was produced under the auspices of the church. The canon of scripture was determined by the church, and that's why the text needs to be read, in my view, in the context of community reflection. You can't pluck one leaf off a single tree and imagine that
explains,
describes or encapsulates an entire landscape. So if a passage in the Old Testament, for example, appears to represent God as vengeful, but if the thrust of the text as a whole is that God's mercy exceeds God's judgment or God's anger, then it's the big picture that counts. So there's a section on scripture and ethics, but I'd also, if I may, just like to say a wee bit about science, because when I was writing this book, I interviewed a number of scientists, not all of whom by any means were people of religious conviction. And one very distinguished physiologist in particular said to me, "Never mind about the theology, Rupert. I'm not all that well informed on the theology, but I do know that Richard Dawkins's views on science are very questionable. It's it's an imposition of a dodgy philosophical icing onto the cake of science." And I just want to draw our listeners' attention to Aubrey Moore, who was a priest in the Church of England, and one of the first people to really welcome the publication of The Origin of Species. He spoke of Darwin coming in the guise of a foe and doing the work of a friend. By this, Moore meant that Christians could now free themselves from a deistic conception of God, whereby the Creator had made a machine-like world, retreated, and then occasionally intervened with a tweak. Aubrey Moore believed that Darwin had restored agency to the world, while at the same time making that agency an expression of what God is, what God is like. Now, that echoes completely what a figure like St. Thomas Aquinas was saying in the 13th century. In his commentary on Aristotle, he remarks that nature is not like wood being made into a ship, but like wood that makes itself into a ship. Now, one of the grosser aspects of the God delusion is that Richard Dawkins completely misinterprets, well, probably all of the five ways of St. Thomas Aquinas, but particularly perhaps the fifth way, which Dawkins thinks is about intelligent design. It's nothing to do with intelligent design. It's to do with purposive behavior, with goal-directedness in nature. Now, what is the cutting-edge biology at the moment, or of the 20th and 21st centuries? It's very much a rediscovery of that understanding.
Fascinating stuff. I wish we had a bit more time than we do, but suffice it to say, this is well worth your time and attention. If you are looking for a short and helpful response to this latest book by Richard Dawkins, then do check out Rupert Short's new book, Outgrowing Dawkins, God for Grown-Ups. It's published by SPCK. It's available wherever you get your books from. I'll leave you just with one quote from some of the many endorsements of the book at the beginning, from a recent guest on this show, Tom Holland, historian and broadcaster, who says, "It's a bracing demonstration that a Christian can myth-bust an atheist quite effectively as vice versa." So, Rupert, it's been real fun. to share a little time with you. Thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for this book as well, and for turning it around so quickly. It's great to see something on the shelves that can hopefully be a complimentary resource for those who are picking this up in the holiday season. Again, it's Outgrowing Dawkins, God for Grown-Ups by Rupert Short. And thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I hope you've been enjoying our festive edition of Unbelievable this week. And as ever, if you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Now, we can't read out on the show all of the emails that we receive, but I do read them all myself personally, and I quite often get back to people as well if it's something that seems to need attention. You can also, of course, get in touch via our social media, @unbelievablejb for Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page. You can also find me with my own account on Instagram, justin.brierley. And it was nice to receive this one from Tammy on Instagram, who said, "I grew up in church, but like most, I wandered away as I grew up. I found myself, though, over the last 3 years on a quest, searching for more meaning and evidence for an almighty God. And your show has inspired me, challenged me, and allowed me to connect my mind and heart. As I'm walking in the final months with my dad at the moment, as he prepares to go to heaven, I'm so grateful that I have a strong faith now. What you do matters." Thank you. Thank you, Tammy. It was lovely to receive that message on Instagram. Christina over on Facebook said, "Just wanted to tell you, I really enjoyed watching John Lennox and Dave Rubin. Dave was so polite and honest. As for Professor Lennox, I could listen to him for hours. He's just amazing. Didn't expect a conversation with two very different people in age, profession, worldview, etc. to be so rich. Well done, Justin." And that has proved quite popular as well, that big conversation episode over on our YouTube channel. In fact, I think the clip we took of Dave Rubin saying why he's no longer an atheist is doing better actually now than the full length discussion. There's also a number of clips from it that we've been putting up on the Unbelievable Facebook page as well, so I hope you've come across some of those, Christina. Lovely to hear from you. Champ got in touch on the Facebook page as well to say, "I don't know if you'll see this, Justin, but your debate with Rationality Rules could only be described as a schooling. Justin completely shut him down on many fronts and was outstanding. Yet," and then in capitals, "at the same time, Justin comes across as a coward. Does he realise the kind of slander and attacks that Rationality Rules and his gang have made against Christians and theists? Yet, during the debate, Justin, while on fire, wanted to hold back so much, tiptoe, and be so sensitive towards Rationality Rules. Forget about Rationality Rules attacks. He shouldn't hold back either way. Defend the faith unapologetically. Be like William Lane Craig. Be blunt with these internet infidels and disbelievers without kissing their whatsits." I'll put in for the actual word. Thank you very much, Champ. I'm so glad you thought I did a good job against Rationality Rules in that Oxford debate. But you obviously feel I didn't need to at any point apologise for putting the boot in occasionally. This one again from Facebook, John Horton says, "God bless you, man. From Tom Holland to Tom Wright, William Lane Craig to Jordan Peterson, your work in bringing together sophisticated and nuanced Christian discussion is absolutely a joy and a privilege to be able to see. Just watched the most recent and had to say thank you." That presumably was the Tom Holland debate at the time you were getting in touch with me. Again, all of those big conversation debates are available from the YouTube channel and, of course, at thebigconversation.show if you want to catch up with any you've missed. And as I mentioned earlier, the final one coming, I think the 10th of January is when we'll be releasing Matt Dillahunty, well known as the host of The Atheist Experience, in conversation with Christian thinker and evangelist Glenn Scrivener on morality and whether atheism can deliver a better world. That's a humdinger too, I can tell you. So really glad to be bringing you that one as the final edition of this year's season of The Big Conversation. Just a quick shout as well to Matthew Morgan, who got in touch. Now, I love the fact that we don't just have Christians and believers listening to Unbelievable, lots and lots of agnostics, atheists, people of other faiths as well. And Matthew says, "I'm an atheist who's benefited greatly from Unbelievable. It's encouraged me to develop a more open-minded and open-hearted approach to religion. I run a website called artofconversation.net, where I publish essays on culture, focusing on how literature, cinema and the arts can explore the big questions of who we are and what we value. One of the latest articles is called 'What's Left of Religion Without Belief?' And in the article, I explore where my journey has taken me, from a fundamentalist evangelical upbringing through shallow Dawkins-style atheism to where I am now regarding Christianity, faith and culture. I still don't accept the truth claims of Christianity, but I see those as only a tenth of what faith does and can do for society and for individuals. The other nine-tenths are what I look at in the article. I thought there might be a chance that you or your listeners might be interested in this contribution to the much larger dialogue, and I name Unbelievable as an influence on my story, so I'm sending the link if you'd like to read it. And again, you can find it at artofconversation.net, and you're looking for the post called Religion Without Faith. And you finish by saying, I must give you a long overdue thank you for all you've done in providing a place for those who disagree to have productive dialogues, sadly in short supply these days. And thank you too for offering us conversations that go deeper into fascinating esoteric aspects of religion, disputes between sects of Christianity and differing interpretations of scripture that are rarely if ever discussed in mainstream media. I'll be listening every week. Matthew, lovely to hear from you, and thank you for pointing out that Unbelievable has been part of that journey you've been on in recent years. And finally, I've been saving this one up for last because I was stunned when I got this email from Joe Fox. Now, Joe is a 22-year-old male living in Ohio, currently a college student studying for a bachelor's in biomedical engineering. And, well, this is how he begins his email. He says, I've finally done it. You can add me as the newest member to the list of those who have listened to every episode of Unbelievable. Yes, 915.4 hours worth of podcast listened to in just under a year and a half. Not to mention the Ask NT Write Anything podcast, which I've also now listened to every episode of. And before you mention it, no, I am most certainly not sick of the sound of your voice. Quite the opposite, in fact. Without the timbre of your voice keeping me company during work, through my commute and while I run, it's beginning to feel quite empty. So I was stunned to receive this, Joe. I feel like you deserve a prize or something for listening to literally the whole of the back catalogue. I assume that's going right back to 2007 when we started podcasting the programme. I'll tell you what, I will send you a signed copy of the Unbelievable book to mark this historic occasion. And if you are someone who has also managed to listen to the whole of the back catalogue of Unbelievable, well, I can't guarantee a signed book, but do get in touch because I'm interested to hear just how many people have made it through, you know, almost 1,000 hours of program in whatever time. But yeah, this was phenomenal. Yet less than a year and a half. That is some binge listening, Joe. Anyway, your email continues. I ran across the podcast while looking for Catholic Protestant debates back in July of 2018, and I instantly fell in love with it. I had only sparingly listened to podcasts at all before that, but I had a list of podcasts I wanted to check out. But that list immediately went out the window after I listened to Unbelievable, as I didn't find myself willing to switch away to any of them again, as I didn't find them nearly as enjoyable as Unbelievable is. I immediately started telling my friends and family about how amazing your show is, and I wouldn't stop talking about it to the point where, less than a month later, my girlfriend at the time brought me the Unbelievable book, which I quite enjoyed. Well, got another one coming your way soon, Joe. I can't compliment Unbelievable enough. Originally, I was just scrolling through the back catalogue looking for episodes that stood out to me, but after listening to a dozen or so, I couldn't help but start from the beginning and just go through each one. Your quality of guests and interesting conversations kept me coming back with excitement to each and every episode. I must say, however, that your fantastic moderating skills are really what sells the show for me. Took a long time of listening to really understand where you even seem to stand on specific issues. And even then, in your interview with Mark Driscoll, I found out that you held views I hadn't expected, which truly is a testament to how impartial you'd stayed through your moderation. You've done fantastic at keeping the conversation on topic, bringing out interesting insights and clarifications from your guests, but also not steering the conversation to be too one-sided. Now, as with everyone who listens to Unbelievable, I have two main issues with it. Firstly, I wish I'd found it sooner. And secondly, I wish each episode could be longer. There's so much to talk about and discuss that 1 hour could never hope to do each topic justice, though you do impress me with how much content you manage to fit into that time slot. Your show's really helped me shape a lot of my views as I've gone on listening to it, and I just wish I could have found it years ago. There was a period of time years ago when I was doubting my faith, and I had to go through a ton of research before I came to a place where I was confident with the intellectual side of Christianity. At that time, I had no idea where to even start looking. Your show has gone over a lot of the topics I had issues with during that period, and I can only imagine where I may be now if I'd found the show then. That aside, I'm glad I found it now, as it's continued to challenge me and give me a lot of food for thought and topics to look further into. All just to say thank you for creating such an incredible space to have open discussions between Christianity and other faiths. It's truly been a blessing. I look forward to listening for many years to come. And if you ever have an Unbelievable event in the Midwest of the United States, I'll definitely be there. Joe, thank you so much. What a lovely email to have received. Very encouraging, firstly, with all those kind compliments about the show. But just an extraordinary thing that you've, in less than a year and a half, listened to so many episodes of the show, so many hours worth of podcasts. So well done. And I look forward to seeing if anyone can equal Joe's record of binge listening to that many episodes of the show in such a short space of time. But for now, it's been lovely to have you on today's edition of the programme. And we'll be back with another holiday edition of the show next week. You're unbelievable. And just a quick reminder before I tell you about that, actually. Unbelievable, the conference 2020 coming Saturday, the 9th of May. NT Wright, our special guest in London. So do put that in your diary and we will bring you the booking details as soon as we can in January. But coming up before the end of the year, one final special holiday edition of the programme in which we'll be bringing you some of the content from Unbelievable USA that was filmed out in California. Things like the panel discussion that took place with John Lennox, Mary Jo Sharp, Jay Warner Wallace and many others contributing. And we'll be hearing an interview I took as well with Mary Jo Sharp about her own journey from atheism to Christian faith. So look out for that as well on next week's edition of the show and podcast that aims to get you thinking every week. For now, thanks to all of my guests who joined me on today's show. Hope you have a really wonderful Christmas and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.